This is essentially a shiur that's related to Parshat Noach, being, you know, timely. You know, I think, as with any shiur, we often begin with the Parsha, and then we see where we can go from there. This is going to be kind of, you know, constrained. It's going to stay within the Parsha on one hand, but on the other hand, I do think, you know, there are some ideas that come out of it that obviously pertain well beyond. So it's going to be sort of, you know, an attempt to understand the text and what's going on one hand, and on the other hand, kind of trying to see where we go from there. So let us begin. Parshat Noach contains probably two of the major narratives that we find in the Torah. Certainly the ones that are, let's say, pre-Klal Yisrael, pre-Avram Avinu, pre-Tziat Mitzrayim, pre-Matan Torah, right? Which is, of course, the Mabul and Migdal Bavel, right? Which are two crucial, obviously, moments in human history as recounted by the Torah. And they are, what I want to show is that I want to show the similarities between them. Now, first of all, before you go any further, I think if you just listen to the two words, you know that there's a linguistic similarity, right? Mabul, right? You have that Bet Lamed sort of root of the word. And then Bavel, right? You have that same Bet Lamed in there. So linguistically, they're similar. Again, not being a linguist, I'm not going to try to get to the roots of it. But, I'm also not the first person to have made this connection. But the fact that you find them in the same Parsha, again, being linked to each other, and I'm going to show you as we go on that there are certain statements within Chazal that show that Chazal are sensitive to this on one hand, and that they're going somewhere with this idea on the other hand. So we want to try to understand what is the linkage, again, not just the linguistic similarity, and not just sort of the superficial similarity, but let's sort of, if we get beneath the surface, what is the similarity between the first part of the Parsha, where the focus is on the Mabul, and the second part of the Parsha, where the focus is on Migdal Bavel and the consequences thereof. I want to focus a little bit more on the first part, a little bit less on the second part, and like I said, this is all within something of a time constraint from my perspective. So let's go from the very beginning. If we go to the Psukim, I always thought there was something interesting about this. This is not the only place that this happens in the Torah, but I always thought that the Psukim at the beginning of Parshas Noach, where Hashem is introducing to Noach what is about to take place, that what happens is a little counterintuitive. So let's take a look, and I hope you'll see why I think so. So the Torah introduces us, of course, Vatishachet Kol Haaretz. I did not give those Psukim on the sheet, right? Vatishachet Haaretz, Lefnei Elokim, the world became completely corrupt, and Hashem saw that the world was completely corrupt, and Hashem decided that it's time to make a drastic change, let's say, right? But Noach, of course, as we know, is going to be the odd man out in this regard. He's going to be the one who is saved from the drastic change. Now, what happens? It's within these Psukim, when Hashem starts to communicate to Noach and starts to tell him that bad things are going to happen, and I want you to be the exception to the rule, where things start getting a little counterintuitive. So listen to what happens. Right? The end of all flesh has come before me, because the world is full of chamas, whatever it is, full of corruption. I'm going to destroy them, whatever that, you know, however we translate that. Again, the Mefarshim have different reads of this. So what does Hashem say to Noach? Make yourself a teva, right? Make yourself an ark out of wood. Hashem gives Noach the precise instructions of the materials that he's going to use to construct the teva, to construct the ark. And next, in Pasuk Tedvav, God continues by giving Noach the precise dimensions that he's supposed to construct the teva. V'zasher ta'aseota shlosh meot amar orech ha-teva, right? 300 amo long. Chamishim amar achba, 50 amo wide. Shloshim amar komata, 30 amo tall. So not only does God tell Noach straight away to construct the teva, he also tells him, hey, here's a list of materials that you're going to use. Here's the list of the precise dimensions of the teva. Now, I don't know if you ever thought about this, but is there any reason for God to have told Noach what the dimensions of the teva should be? I mean, the teva would seem to be more of a goal-oriented kind of structure, right? We know.
We had to know how big it's going to be in order to be able to fit all these animals. I don't know. Would know.
So that's interesting, like, right? So couldn't God have just told him, "Listen, you're taking all the animals in. Mm-hmm. Make it big." Right. Make it really
God,
big.
In all the places where God gives very little detail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, We don't eat milk and meat together and keep 6 hours because you can't cook a calf in its mother's milk. That's the only thing he says, and we build this whole thing around it. Here
right.
He goes into great detail.
Great detail for something that would seem, at least from my perspective, not just intuitive, but more like functional, right? You want to tell me the Mishkan has to have precise detail. I actually understand that, right? Because we're talking about a spiritual space where precision is of the utmost importance, right? So for God to say these need to be the dimensions because we're going to create a holy space here makes sense to me. But when it comes to the Teva, to the ark that Noah had to make, well, there it seems a little bit less intuitive. Again, like I said, the Teva would seem to be more functional and less...
Hashem wasn't going to tell him how high the waters were going to be and how strong.
Okay, good. So Hashem didn't tell him how high the waters would be, how strong. Good, 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 good. There's something else Hashem hasn't told him yet, by the way. Think about it for a second. But so first Hashem tells him, here are the materials. Then Hashem tells him, here are the dimensions, right? Then in Pasuk Zion continues. Tzohar tasela teva ve'alamatech alen amilamala. You'll make a tzohar for the teva, right? You put the door on the side and make it three stories. So,
I mean, here he doesn't say yet who's going to go in the teva.
He doesn't go in the teva. You know what else God hasn't told Noach yet? Why an ark? Why not a bomb shelter? Why not, we haven't heard about floods yet, right? It takes, from the time that Hashem tells Noach that he's got to create a shelter because something is going to happen, until the time that he actually gets to the specifics of what's going to happen, right? It takes 1, 2, 3, right? It's only the fourth pasuk there that finally Hashem says, Va'ani hinani mevi et hamabo mayim al haaretz. I don't know if Noach measured his conversation with God in terms of psukim, but we can, right? And by the way, Noach, you know why you're doing all this? Because it's about to get wet. It's about to get really, really... So in theory, wouldn't it make sense to first say there's going to be a mabul, so therefore you're going to need a teva, right? So all I'm saying is, when I approach this sort of intuitively, my inclination is to say the teva is a functional space that's designed to protect Noach and the animals. And in other words, like some sample of all the different species on Earth from the waters. But what I'm seeing here is the instruction to construct the Teva precedes the knowledge that there's going to be a flood, number one. And the notion that there's such precision involved in the construction of the Teva, number two, also, you know, kind of makes me wonder what exactly this is all about. And then another thing I want to focus on is the first word of Pasuk Tet Zayin, Tzohar. What's a tzohar?
A window.
A window.
Or a jewel.
Or a jewel. Okay, good. What does that mean, a window or a jewel?
Something that you can see out of or doesn't let you see outside.
The interesting. So either it lets you see out or it doesn't let you see out. Okay, so that's a obviously drastically different approach, right? So the tzohar, we have a sense, is meant to be some sort of illumination. Right? And I want to show you first the Midrash, then the Gemara, then go back to the Midrash. This idea that it's either a window or it's a precious stone, right? That comes from Rashi, right? But Rashi gets it from somewhere. So let's look at the Midrash, first of all. The second source on your sheet is from Bereishit Rabbah, commenting on these psukim. Tzohar ta'asel ha-teva. So first it tells us that Rabbi Chunya, Rabbi Pinchas, Rabbi Chanan, Rabbi Hoshea, lo mefarshin. You have four great rabbis, they did not even wade into what this is. Okay, Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Rabbi Levi Mefarshin, Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, and Rabbi Levi, they did take a stab at what the Tzohar is. We're not going to talk right now, or actually during this year at all, why certain rabbis did not try to explain the Tzohar. We are going to talk about the two approaches to what the Tzohar was. So what does he say? Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana Amar Chalon, self-explanatory, right? Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said it was a window. Rabbi Levi Amar Margalit, Rabbi Levi says, no, it was a jewel, exactly. Why? What's a window and what's a jewel? Right? So, well, Baruch told us before, one allows a light in from the outside, and one kind of illuminates without the outside, right? So that is what the way we normally interpret this. In other words, what is the machloket here? In other words, whenever we have a machloket, we have to try to get to what do they agree about, what do they disagree about.
So I don't know what a window was in those days. I don't know if they had glass.
Right.
So a window might be an opening.
Correct.
Whereas a jewel is a closing. In other words, you can't get the water. You don't want the water to come in through a window. No, you want to be, have something there that puts the light in.
Okay, interesting.
Allow water to come in.
So good. So in other words, so wait. So let's. So first of all, we're talking about potentially again. A kind of pragmatic approach to it, right? In other words, why would we want a window? We want light, right? We don't want to just put them all in a box and tell them you're going to spend the duration of this time period in a box, right? So you put a window in the teva in order for there to be some source of illumination. Good. That's one approach. And then what would be the goal then of putting a jewel? So that might be, assuming that we're talking about some jewel with you know, very unusual properties that it could provide illumination for the teva, what we're saying is, that's where the source of light came from, so a window was unnecessary. Okay, so one reason for it might very well be to keep them dry, right? To keep the water outside, right? Another thing I think Baruch was alluding to before is to kind of seal the teva off, right? So the light doesn't have to come from outside of the teva, the light can come from inside of the teva. Okay.
The jewel is self-illuminating?
Well, I don't know of any jewels right now that are self-illuminating. I'm sure there, you know, there's some. We're talking about, right, that whatever it is.
It could certainly be a jewel that served as a prism and magnified the light that did come into the teva.
So then we're assuming that the light came in from the teva, came into the teva.
Through the jewel.
Right. Right, okay. So...
there with the jewel, one of the conclusions is that it provides a light, but you can't see out, you can't see through the jewel.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that might be, at least in our first read, what Rabbi Levi is getting at, right? When Rabbi Levi says it's a margalit, what he's saying is, we, you know, in other words, the disagreement would seem to be over whether the teva should be open or closed, right? That Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, who says it's a window, he is arguing that the teva should be open to a certain extent. Rabbi Levi, who says it's a jewel that illuminates the teva, is saying the teva should be closed and the illumination should come from within the teva. Hence the title of the shir, Illuminating from Without, Illuminating from Within, trying to understand what the Tzohar is all about. That's the tactic, I think, that the Gemara takes. And like I said, that's what Rashi quotes also. The Gemara gave you as an interlude, Bavli Sanhedrin 108b. The Gemara says in Masechet Sanhedrin, Tzohar Tasela Teva, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Menoach, Kvaba Avanim Tovot Umargaliot, put precious jewels and stones in the Teva, Kedei Shihum Irot Lachem Katzoharayim, in order that it should be illuminated like the afternoon. In other words, somehow these jewels, whether it was through acting like a prism or whether it was by some other kind of property that they had, the jewels would serve as a source of illumination. They would be the lights of the teva, right? Like I said, Rashi in his commentary here essentially quotes this Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin, and that's what I think if you read most people who talk about the debate over whether Tzohar was, you'll see basically Rashi's position via the Gemara in Sanhedrin being reflected that either, again, that's about illumination, and the question is, where does the illumination of the Teva come from? Okay? And obviously, you know, philosophically, there are interesting places to go with that.
So
yes?
When Noah lets the dove, he lets it out of the window or opens the door?
Good question. I don't know. I think if he had opened the door at that point, the teva probably would have flooded. So obviously he opens something on the teva, but who knows, you know, exactly. Right. Okay, good. So it's possible that it was a window. Sorry? So it could be, or we have, you know, it could have been a trap. Who knows, you know, exactly how he did it. But wait, let's go further. I'm going to show you that the Midrash actually, if we go back to, I should point out, by the way, just chronologically speaking, the Midrash and the Midrash, at least Bereishis Rabbah, is earlier than the Gemara. It was sort of sealed as a text, it was concluded as a text before the before the Gemara. So the ideas in it, you know, sometimes the Gemara will take ideas that you'll find in the earlier Midrashim and will either elaborate on them or work on them. Here, you'll see, if you go back to the original Midrash, and we go back to the way the Gemara, the Midrash elaborates on Rabbi Levi's opinion, it's actually going to throw us for a loop, because this is our fourth source on the page, back to the Midrash. And what does it say? Rabbi Pinchas Mishim Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Pinchas is explaining Rabbi Levi's position. Rabbi Levi said it's a jewel, a margalit. Here's what Rabbi Pinchas explains. Kol Yud Bet Chodesh Hayah Noach Bateva, Lo Tzarach Leor Chama Bayom, for the entire 12 months that Noach was in the Teva, he never needed the light of the sun during the day, nor did he need the light of the moon at night. Again, so far, if we stop here, we know why, right? Because the Tzohar provided him the light that he needed, right? But listen to what Rabbi Pinchas says, because to me, This is mind-blowing. It's a game-changer. Ella margalit haitalo v'haya toleota. He had a margalit, he had this stone, and he would hang it up in the teva. B'shah shehi keha haya yodea shehu yom. U'b'shah shehi mevaheket haya yodea shehu laila. According to this, right, the jewel would glow or would dim, and the glowing or the dimming of the jewel would let Noach know if it was day or night outside. Mm-hmm. So the Tzohar, if it's a precious jewel here, is not a lamp, mm-hmm. It's a clock. Right? That's essentially what he's telling us, right? It's not there to provide, huh?
A clock?
A clock.
Whether it's day or not.
It's telling whether it's day or night, right? The Tzohar glows or dims, and based on the glowing or dimming of the Tzohar, Noach is able to know day outside, night outside, right? Which is...
Well, Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Potter. No, the ceiling in the hall.
It shows
the stars during the night. It shows the sun.
Right. It's good that you made a literary reference, because my point of reference to this is going to be if you ever went to a casino in Las Vegas...
Okay.
They keep the ceiling, the ceilings are painted sort of like a dim blue, and they keep the lights on 24 hours a day, and there are no windows. So you never have any, unless you have, your own way of telling time, you can never tell naturally what time it is when you're inside those buildings. For less noble reasons than what was going on in the Teva, I would imagine. But like I said, to me, this is a game changer, right? Because all along we're just talking about how does Noach illuminate the Teva? Is it through light from the outside or is it through light from the inside? And like I said, if you want to go with that and you want to create a drasha around that, right, it's very easy to create a drasha around that because it's a question of whether, according to one opinion amongst the Amoraim, one opinion in the Midrash, it's about whether the Teva should be connected to the outside world even during the flood. And according to the other opinion in the Midrash, it's about the Teva being a closed-off space, right, that did not have a natural connection to the world. And that was, that's a nice direction to go with it. But once you have this other explanation, Rabbi Pinchas' explanation of Rabbi Levi, who says that the Tzohar was there to tell Noach whether it was day or night, the question is, why? What is this all about? What is this Tzohar? What is it doing in the Teva? Why is it so important, so necessary for the residents of the Teva to have this, especially if Rabbi Levi... You see, the other thing is to understand that what Rabbi Pinchas agrees with is that if the Tzohar was a precious stone, then the Teva is sealed off from the outside, right? If the Tzohar is... doing this glowing and dimming thing, then that shows us that they have no idea. They're not able to see outside of the Teva, right? Mm-hmm. Everything that they need and everything that's happening for them is taking place within this hermetically sealed space called the Ark. And why do they need the Tzohar then? Why do they need anything to be telling them now is day, now is night, now is day, now is night? I assume Noach was not putting on tefillin because A, he wasn't Jewish, B, he was before Matan Torah, C, I'm not sure around all those animals you're allowed to put on tefillin anyway. So what does he need this for? So I'm going to add that to the... Yes?
He probably needs it because it's part of nature. Right? You need a certain amount of waking hours, certainly sleeping hours. But I'm going to ask now, is it Tzohar above nature? Or it's kind of recreating nature inside.
So it's kind of recreating nature inside, right?
So is it above nature that it's living and lived, or is it...
So that's a fascinating question to ask about here. Like, in other words, so what is this, right?
Just add another dimension to it. Tzar, one would think the objective of Tzar would be to give light.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a jewel or something that shines in the daytime but dims at night, it sort of defeats the purpose of having Tzar.
Right. Right. So... Good. So again, the specific hours of the shining and the dimming is not entirely what concerns me, but I do like this idea of the Tzohar recreating nature within the Teva, because I think if you look at what's happening with the Mabul, then you get a sense that let's take the word Mabul here. Let's do that. I gave you Rashi's commentary on what the word Mabul might mean, right? So what does he say? Rashi gives three potential explanations, right? Again, all playing with that root, Mabul, right? What is it? She bilat hakol, which basically means it kind of destroyed everything. She bilbel et hakol, right? And here you kind of already start seeing an allusion, like we were saying before, to Migdal Bavel, right? Bilbel, mixed everything up. Shehovil et hakol min gavol l'namuch, moved everything around, right? Those are the explanations. Rashi is playing with that word mabul, but when Rashi plays with the word mabul, I think there's a common thread going between those. And David, I think this is kind of where you were going with it. There's a sense that what the mabul did was take a world that has certain rules, take a world that has a certain order to it, and just completely throw everything out of whack, right? It's not just a destruction of the world. It's the way in which the world is destroyed. Shebilbel et hakol, everything gets mixed up, right? What happens when things get mixed up? So then rules no longer apply. And then, again, what we consider to be nature, orderly, predictable, right? That's out of whack. Shehovil et hakol min hagavol namoch, everything is displaced, says Rashi, right, in his third explanation. Again, same idea. Things don't go where they're supposed to go. Things don't fit where they're supposed to fit. Things are moving from here to there in a somewhat unnatural way, and that's...
Right, after the mabul, that's when things, you know, then there was kites and carp, then that's when...
Brilliant,
you know,
good.
That's when everything was set back the way it was supposed to
good.
Be.
Good. I think that's the next source on the page, right? But I think that's exactly where we're going with this, right? Because what does Hashem say, right? As soon as, this is before Hashem talks to Noach about it, right? This is, interestingly, right? This is, listen to what the Pesukim say. So Noach comes out of the Teva, right? This is the next source on page. Vayivin Noach mizbeach Hashem, vayikach mikol ha-bayima ha-tahora, mikol ha-of ha-tahor, vayal ha-lop ha-mizbeach, vayarach Hashem ha-sreach ha-nichoach. Hashem smells the pleasing odor of the korban. Again, all of this is, all of these are, you know, big questions, what that means. Again, the way the Torah is describing this to us here, this is not even Hashem talking to Noach, right? When Hashem talks to Noach, you're going to see, I didn't give it you on the sheets, you're going to see a full sort of reset of creation and of the creation of civilization, right? He's going to talk to him about Peru Ravu. He's going to talk to him about basically, essentially, all the things that Hashem had said to Adam are now going to be said to, not some, in a somewhat different way, to Noach again. In other words, God is resetting the laws, right, after the mabul. But it's not just that God says this to the humans, because to say it to the humans makes sense, right? Because now here they've just undergone a traumatic experience, and everything they know has been wiped out. So to say to them, go reproduce, resettle the earth, live the way you're supposed to live, you know, recreate all of creation, that, again, I would understand. And I wouldn't see anything too shocking about that, even if, you know, Hashem says to Noach, it's time to sort of put everything back into order, put everything back the way it's supposed to be. But what's interesting here is that here, the way the Torah tells it to us, it is, kivyachol, God talking to God's self. Vayomer Hashem elibo. Hashem said to himself, Hashem said to his heart, whatever on earth that could possibly mean, right? I won't curse the earth for the human being any longer. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam rami ne'urav. Oh, right, then we skip to the last pasuk. Od kol yimei ha'aretz, zera v'katzir, v'kor v'chom, v'kaitz v'chorav, v'yom v'alayel lo yishvotu. In other words, it's very telling to me that that's, like I said, God's own narration of these events, that here God says, you know what, never again will things be thrown completely out of whack. Never again will there not be day and night. Never again will there not be summer and winter. Never again will there not be hot and cold, right? So here you have a sense, and again, this is, I think all of the sources are leading to this idea that the mabul was a not just a decimation of the world, but taking everything that was meant to be in a specific way, nature, order, etc., throwing everything completely out of whack. That was the nature of how God destroyed the world. God didn't just punish people. God didn't just, you know, do X, but God completely mibalbel, movil, right, threw everything out of whack, completely disoriented, put things where they're not supposed to be, and that's what the mabul was all about. And I think what's interesting is, just to jump ahead a little bit, that's what I think Migdal Bavel is all about also. And again, we know that from its the basic narration of Migdal Bavel, because it tells us, here's what was, and here's what happened afterwards, but I think there's more to it than that. Right? Again, we know the Pesukim of Migdal Bavel, but let's just go through it again. Vayihi kol ha'aretz shafa achas u'dvarim achadim, right? Everybody spoke a single language, they all had dvarim achadim. Again, what shafa achas u'dvarim achadim means? It basically means that everyone was able to communicate with each other. Okay? That's fine. Fine. They, when they went from the east, they settled in a valley in the land of Shinar, which we'll see soon what the significance of Shinar is. Vayomru, you'll see this over again here. Vayomru Ishare Ehu, right? Havanil Banal Vanivanisrefalisrefa, let's make bricks. Again, interestingly, the Torah doesn't just say they made bricks. Right? There are other times when the Torah talks about discoveries, right? When it talks about the children of Lamech, right? So he discovered X, he figured out Y, right? But here, it's not the humans discovered how to make bricks, but they said to each other, let's make bricks, right? And you'll see the next pasuk again. Vayomru, hava nivne lanu ir. They didn't just set out to create a city, but the building of the city is preceded by statement. They speak to each other. Vayomru. They say to each other, let's build a city and a tower that reaches the heavens, right? Why is it so important to say over and over again, to tell us that the people are speaking, the people are speaking? You know, so if we're, you know, reading the Torah as literature, in the, which is a legitimate way of doing it, you see that it's building towards Hashem mixing up all the languages, right? Here, they're all speaking one language, they're speaking, and communication is crucial. And so that when Hashem realizes that they're using their ability to speak for evil purposes, then we understand why it is that Hashem gets down there, and the consequence of this is the mixing up of all the languages, right? Okay, fine. But again, let's just continue with this a little bit more. So let's just jump to Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Hashem, Hein Am Echad V'Safa Achat L'Kulam V'Zachilam La'asot. They're one nation. They speak a single language, and this is what they're meant to do. Va'ata Lo Yibatzer Mehem Kol Asher Yazmu La'asot. So now we're not going to basically let them get. We're not going to let them get away with this. Hava Ner Dav Nivlasham Svatam Asher Lo Yishmu Ish Svat Re'ehu. Let's get down there and let's mix up their languages, so that no one will be able to understand anyone else's language, right? And that's what happened. Vayifetz Hashem Lotam Misham Al Pnei Kol Haaretz. Hashem spread them out from all throughout the face of the earth, and they stopped building the city. Al Kain Karashima Bavel, Kisham Balal Hashem Svas Kol Haaretz, Misham Hefitzam Hashem Al Pnei Kol Haaretz. In other words, it's not just that God changed, you know, mixed up all their languages. It's that that's such a monumental, momentous occasion in human history that Bavel. Now, think about Bavel. You know, if you're a reader of the Torah, any time up until the end of the Nevi'im, the Tekufa of the Nevi'im, saying, wow, that's the origin of Bavel. I mean, Bavel is a major place, right? Bavel is, I mean, actually, beyond that, right? Into the time of Chazal, Bavel is a major place. So, wow, the origin of Bavel somehow is the fact that God mixed up everybody's languages. So again, we have this communication, they speak to each other, they say to each other, Hashem ultimately decides to change their languages, and you have to wonder, why is that the focus of the story? The speaking, the saying, the mixing up of the languages, right? And I think here's how it might, to a certain extent, relate to the Mabul as well. Because here, too, we find an eradication of nature, as it's created. Why? I didn't give you this as a source because I also had a limited amount of space to use for source creating, but very famously, probably the most famous, one of the most famous Targumim of Unculus, for those of us who are not great experts in Targum Unculus, many of us are still able to quote one famous commentary, one famous translation of Unculus, which is Vayihi ha'adam le'nefesh chaya. The Adam that God created, when God created humanity, right? That was last week. And the human being became a nefesh chaya, which literally means like a living soul, a living being. Unculus' famous translation of that is a ruach mimalila, a speaking creature. Which means, and you see this reflected in classic Jewish philosophy, and you see this reflected in Kabbalah as well, that what Unculus is telling us, if the ruach chaya, the living soul of the human being, is the capacity for speech, then what most defines us as humans is our ability to speak. Now, what does it mean to speak? I mean, you know, I hate to sound like a... Huh? To communicate, exactly. Speech is relevant when other people are there with whom you communicate. You know, as a former congregational rabbi, I can tell you that sometimes speech happens and there's nobody to whom you're communicating, right? But it happens from time to time that, you know... The famous story about the different rabbanim and how they reacted to seeing a room full of sleeping people. But you know, there's always What was that one? There was, we once had our shul dinner in the middle of tax season. It happened to be that our honoree was an accountant who used to fall asleep during my speech every single Shabbos, no matter what. So we asked, why is it that we made this shul dinner during tax season? Because we knew that if he didn't have the speech during the shul dinner, he would be working. But now that we give him a speech during the shul dinner, he can get a good nap and he can be refreshed and he can go and do all the things that he has to do. So, but all joking aside, right, to say that the human being is a ruach mamalala, is a speaking creature, to say that speech is what most exemplifies and what most encapsulates what the human being is to say that by nature, human beings are meant to speak, i.e. to communicate with each other, that we are a communicative species, and that if the world were to go, you know, if we were to live in the way that God intended it, when God created Adam HaRishon, according to that interpretation, it would all be about communication. And if that's the case, let's go back to the story of Migdal Babel. When we see that the people are communicating with each other, and the Torah builds to that, right? Vayomru, Vayomru, Vayomru. Not just to tell us they discovered something, but to tell us they discovered it by speech. They communicated with each other. Well, in theory, that's human beings doing exactly what God intended human beings to do. In theory, that's human beings living according to, if we could use this word, what the nature of the human being is. If the nature of the human being is a speaking creature, is a communicative creature, then when the humans, vayomru yeshalachiv, vayomru yeshalachiv, over and over again, that's humans doing exactly what they're supposed to do. What's the problem? The problem is what they're doing with that power, what they're doing with their nature, is not the right thing. And so, when Hashem decides to mix up the languages of the humans, it's not just a coincidence, and it's not just a choice of, you know, one particular punishment, but there's a specific message, which is that what God is essentially doing is messing with human nature as God created it. That nature, the rules of nature, are now being thrown out of whack, just as during the Mabul, right? If the Mabul is all about disorientation, if the Mabul is all about taking rules, taking nature, taking things that are supposed to work in a specific way, and saying they're not going to work in this way, right? Mibalbel, Movil, taking things and disorienting everything and putting things where they're not supposed to be. Well, that's exactly what takes place during the Migdal Babel as well. Here's nature of the human being, Vayomru Yishel Achiv. This is the way things are ostensibly supposed to be. God says, well, if that's the way it's working out, then human nature itself is going to be victim, so to speak, or is going to be the site of the punishment between that God meets out upon these individuals who are doing the terrible thing that they're doing. And I think it's really fascinating that Chazal, I think, not just, again, see not just the linguistic connection, but they throw us a little nugget. They, you know, sometimes you have these little one-liners, in especially in Agada, that when you read them, you're like, you know, either it's just, you know, rabbis saying things, or there's something deeper behind it. Look at the last source on your sheet. It's a quote. It's a one-liner from the Gemara in Masechet Zevachim. That daf in Masechet Zevachim, daf Kofiyud Gimel Mabed, happens to be dealing a lot with the Mabul and interpretations, you know, exegesis of the section of the Torah of Parsha Noach. But here it kind of jumps to the name, some of the names that are given to Babel. Metzula, right? Now, Metzula, we know, kind of means like deep area, swampy area, right? That's a Metzula. And Shinar. It takes those two names of Babel and it asks, why is it that Babel is given those names? Metzula, Shinar, right? So, Damar Shlakesh, Lama Nikra Shema Metzula, Shekol Meitei Mabul, Nitzdal Lelusham. All of the dead of the Mabul end up somehow in Babel. That's where they're all interred. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Lama Nikra Shema Shinar, Shekol Meitei Mabul, Ninarusham. Because all of those who died in the Mabul were poured in there, essentially, right? That's what Ninaru essentially means, right? What Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish are both telling us then, and again, like I said, this is one of those one-liners. The Gemara, I didn't put this on your sheet. I'm not sure whether I should tell it to you. This is almost in bad taste, but the Gemara says, if you eat things that grow in the dust, that grow in the ground of Babel, it's like you're eating your own ancestors. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what the Gemara says. I don't understand why exactly, because we are, in theory, all descended from Noah, who actually survived the Mabul, but putting that one logical discrepancy aside, What is the Gemara doing?
He didn't end up in Babel.
Huh?
He didn't end up in Babel.
He didn't. Right, he also didn't end up in Babel. That's true, right? But like I said, it's sort of these like one-liners by Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish. But what are they doing for us? What Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish are both doing is establishing a connection somehow between the Mabul and Migdal Bavel. That somehow the death of the that there's some natural or unnatural, there's some connection between those who died in the Mabul and the land of Bavel. And I think, yeah.
Because they were eating their ancestors and they got the
okay. There was threat from them. But in all seriousness, I think what we're seeing here is, if you look at, you know, this notion that the underlying theme, that this root of, you know, Bet Lamed, Mabul, and Bavel, that somehow they both point to mixing things up and taking natural rules and taking things the way that they're supposed to be and throwing them all out of whack, well, then it makes sense that the Mete Mabul would end up in Bavel. Bavel, the place where human nature is thrown out of whack in a later generation, is where the victims of the Mabul, where God took the laws of nature and messed with them, that's where they all end up. Like I said, I will...
Bavel, we talk about here, Migdal Bavel, etc., is that basically the same areas where Bavel today is that considered the same area?
To the best of my knowledge, it's considered the same area. Certainly in the time of the Gemara, it's considered the same area. You could read, you know, it's very interesting, parenthetically. The Chazal get a little ambivalent about Bavel, because they like the yeshivot that are there, they like the Torah that's learned there, but you could read it. It's Masechet Sanhedrin, Masechet Zvachim, all kinds of interesting things that the Gemara has kind of kicks around when it comes to Bavel, whether it's a good place or a bad place or whatever it is. But putting that aside for a moment, here's what we have then, okay? What we have right now is the Mabul and Migdal Bavel are both about throwing things out of whack. And I want to go back then to our opening questions, to our analysis of the psukim that pertain to the Mabul and to our attempt to understand the Tzohar. Because what I think we have here then, we might start to explain certain things to us, and it's some things that people touched on during the course of the learning, right? Why is it, we said, it seems a little counterintuitive, to first give Noach the materials of the Teva, the dimensions of the Teva, and then tell him, by the way, there's going to be a flood. To first tell Noach, you know, and by the way, why does the Teva have to, like we asked before, why does the Teva have to have dimensions at all? Why can't it just be a functional box? The answer, or a functional boat, or, you know, raft, whatever you want to say. And I think what we're getting at is, especially when it comes to things like dimensions, and especially when it comes to things like time, right, Rabbi Pinchas' explanation of what the Tzohar is that what the Teva was, I mean, and David, you alluded to this to a certain extent also, it was an attempt to create a little island of rationality in a world where all rules and rationality were being thrown out. Here you have God literally throwing out all rules of nature, everything that's predictable, everything that seems to be understandable, everything that makes sense in the world. Laws of science that seem to be the most fundamental things that we can understand are being literally eradicated. And the Teva, the survive, is not just a place for humanity to survive, and it's not just a place for animals to survive, but it's a place for rules and nature and laws to survive. And so the Teva has to be a place that is defined. The Teva has to be a place that has specific dimensions, because it has to be a place where, again, rationality still works. And I think that's also this discussion of the Tzohar, right? The discussion of the Tzohar, is it a light coming from the outside, or is it a clock essentially coming from the inside? So, on one hand, obviously, there's a disagreement here. Was the Teva exposed to the elements, or was the Teva not exposed to the elements, right? About that, they disagree. What they seem to have in common, though, is a notion that they had to know in the Teva what's going on outside of the Teva. Why? Because the Teva had to be a place where rationality and rules and science and predictability continued to hold and continued to be applicable, because, like we saw, when the humans and the animals did exit the Teva, they had to be able to recreate a world and to function in a world that had those rules, and that had that science, and that had the predictability.
On the one hand, you're saying the rules change, on the other hand, you're saying the rules stay the same.
Well, what I'm saying is outside the rule. The whole nature of the Mabul is that the rules change. Everything that's going on outside of the table. I'm sorry, give me half a second.
Certain rules on the inside were changed.
Okay.
The animals didn't attack the humans, and the animals didn't attack each other.
That is true. Okay, that is true. That you know, to a certain extent they change. That's true. But in general, right? That's a good point. Although we do have, there is a midrash, right, about the sort of the lion getting annoyed and kind of going after Noach, right? So there's still a sense that you know, right? The Noach, it's famous midrash, right? That Noach was once late in feeding the lion, and so the lion took a swipe at him. So it was just maybe that was also there to just, you know, remind Noach that this is the real world in here, buddy. You know, this is not the lion and the lamb. You know, I guess it was the lion and the lamb, but not entirely. So, in any case, I think that's what we're getting at. You know, it's just very interesting to me also, sort of the question of, you know, creating those kind of spaces. You know, if you want to take it beyond just the parsha, the notion that, you know, sometimes you find yourself in a world in which, you know, things are less predictable, less clear, harder to understand, much more ambiguous than they used to be, and the ability to be able to create a space, right? The ability to be able to create in which there, you know, there is still some degree of predictability, in which there is still some degree of familiarity, in which there is still some degree of comfort. And again, this could be applied to any kind of situations, right? It could be applied to, you know, our lives as individuals, where sometimes we need to be able to create a space, whether it's a mental space or a physical space for ourselves, where when everything else around us seems to be going crazy, we have that place to kind of, you know, go and be mindful and focused. You know, as religious people, we sometimes need that when we see that the world around us is you know, not necessarily living in accordance with the lifestyle that we think is the right way to do it. So we create spaces for ourselves in which, you know, again, sometimes physical spaces, like a Beit Midrash, and sometimes, again, mental spaces. And the question of the Tzohar is the question of what is the nature of those spaces? Do we have it, do we say that we're going to, you know, sort of, we are where logic continues to abide. We are where rationality continues to abide. And so we follow that model of Rabbi Levi, in which the Tzohar is this jewel that kind of tells us day, night, here are the rules, right? And you don't have to have any kind of connection to the outside world. Or do we follow the, you know, Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, who says, no, the Tzohar is a window, and even when you create that space for yourself, and even when you are sealed off from whatever is happening outside, you can't be hermetically sealed. There still has to be some kind of connection between yourself and the world outside, between the space that you create for yourself and the space in which, you know, you are safe and in which your values continue to abide, and whatever else is going on outside. These are really two different models, and the question is, either do we choose one and reject the other? Do we look for the, you know, the different times in our life and the different times in our world that each of those would be relevant? The question of how we apply those two different models is, I think, a question that's open for discussion, but I think due to the time constraints, we're not exactly going to have time for that particular discussion this evening. I hope, though, that if nothing else, it'll give you something to think about when you learn Parshas Noach.